Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, have you fully recovered from our trip to Nashville?
I thought you were going to say from lunch in the fried green tomato bacon taco that I have. So I haven't even fully recovered from that yet. But yeah, the Nashville trip, what a blast that was. And we ate well there, too, at the Black Eyed Pea.
That's right. Exciting. We're looking at talking to some folks over there, maybe opening a studio in Nashville.
And then this morning, while we were having our breakfast break, second breakfast, we were talking to our new affiliate in Wilmington that we're going to get that off the ground in December, right?
That's right. Lots of things happen in 2014 for Business Radio X.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And the reason is because we have such good programming, and today is no exception. This is going to be a fantastic segment. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Austin Dixon, Executive Director, Literary, how do you say this, Austin?
Literacy Action.
You have to be literate to say it. Literacy Action. And we're going to catch up with Dick Jones, Founder and President of Jones Simply Sales. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this afternoon, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome back to the Business Radio X microphone Mr. Mark Dvorak with Golan Harris. How you doing, man?
I'm doing wonderful. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
So now, we've had several of your people come through here, but you don't come around that often.
No, I've been here with a couple of clients before, and I've sat in the back of the room and watch and observe, and that's typically where I tend to do better, is getting clients prepared to come and speak to you, but today is my day.
That's right, and it's your day because you're going to talk to us about joining the Order of the Phoenix.
I think
sounds very Harry Potter-ish.
You know, exactly. I was at a restaurant a couple of weeks ago in Vining's, a really popular restaurant, and I was reading the menu, and I came across something that said the Order of the Phoenix, and I called our executive director, and I said, oh, my gosh, they named something after us. And she said, Mark, I really do think that's from Harry Potter.
So what is the Order of the Phoenix?
The Order of the Phoenix has been around about 27 or 28 years, and it is kind of the lifetime honor for public relations professionals in Atlanta. As I think you may know, we have the second largest chapter of the Public Relations Society of America here in Georgia, with nearly 900 members. And if you get to be of a certain age and have contributed, you have the chance of being inducted into the Order of the Phoenix. And it's a tremendous honor. And with it comes your picture up in the University of Georgia Grady School of Journalism. So I get to go see that this week.
Did you go to University of Georgia?
I did not go to UGA. I went to a small school in Louisiana. But what's been great about UGA is I now can officially say I have a football team to root for because and go Dogs this weekend.
So now how does University of Georgia play into why is that where the
it's where the Hall of Fame is? It's where the Hall of Fame happens to be. What's really cool is in addition to the PR section, they've got the Newspaper Hall of Fame, and if you look, I mean, Ralph McGill, names you know, Margaret Mitchell is up on the wall.
Really?
There. And wow. So my picture and Margaret Mitchell's are hanging room on the same wall.
Wow, congratulations.
So what is it about Atlanta and really the greater metro area that makes it such a PR hub? Because it really is, isn't it?
You know, part of it is we've got such big major corporations with Coke and UPS and Home Depot and everybody. We've got offices of major public relations firms, most of the major firms here, and then some great local firms that are headquartered here. And in talking to one of my colleagues just this week, one of the things that we hit upon was there is such a cooperative, collaborative attitude here that everybody knows everybody. And as I tell students in particular, you know, you better be nice to people because you never know when you're going to run into that person again. I think it's just while other cities may have reputation of being a little more cutthroat, Atlanta and Georgia, we look out for each other.
Now, when you talk to students that are, maybe they're considering PR as a career or they're just graduated, do you find that it's the same advice that people gave you when you were starting out, or is this a whole new world of PR?
You know, I think one of my biggest piece of advice, besides being nice to people, is get your writing skills down crisp. And I think more and more people are under the impression that because we're writing in 140 characters for Twitter as opposed to long, you know, that
like sentences,
that they don't have to they don't have to master those skills like they used to. But I would say the basics still apply. Mm-hmm. Tell the truth, build solid relationships, you know, do the right thing, master your communication skills. The basics are still there. The tools we use, social media, technology, those are different, but the foundation is the same.
Well, and the depth and breadth of this profession is so much more than I think the typical novice realizes. Like, I think, I for one, I can tell you before we had an opportunity to build all these relationships with PR people over the last few years in our capacity of running a studio, I thought the PR guy was the guy that stepped up and kept the politician from, you know, saying something. So I kind of had a feel for the crisis management piece of it, but there's so much more to PR than that. It covers a whole breadth of things, doesn't it?
It's, you know, it's about building relationships between any organization and its constituents, you know, whether it be donors or shareholders or employees or the community. It's reputation management. It is the crisis communications. It's message development, and then it's the social media aspects and those types of things. So it's huge and it's broad. And there are people within our profession who are media relations folks whose job it is to work with folks like you and newspaper and other broadcast media to help get a story across. But there's so much more to what we do than just the media relations aspect.
Now, when that person is just graduating college and they have their degree in PR, is there the pros and cons of joining an agency like yours or working for a client directly in maybe a social media capacity? That seems to be like kind of an entry-level position nowadays where, because they're 20, so they must know what, you know, social media, how that works, right?
Is there? You know, I tell everybody, I've worked in government, agency twice, and nonprofit. And I think everybody needs to do a stint at an agency mm-hmm. because the skills you develop in terms of working with clients and having to manage your time, keeping timesheets, managing budgets, all those kinds of things, regardless if you stay in an agency capacity the rest of your career, it's just phenomenal practical experience. Mm-hmm. And then go into whatever else you want to do. And I would also say to folks, do internships. 1, 2, 3, you know, multiple opportunities to have experience actually practical on the ground. Because if I'm looking at a resume to hire somebody, if you haven't had a couple of internships, you probably won't make the short list.
Really? Because you want somebody that's at least experienced something.
Something. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can have the best grades, you can have all the school activities, but that nothing beats that practical experience.
I'll tell you something else that's really surprised me about PR, and I guess you just don't know what you don't know. But we've had what I would characterize as relatively small firms in here that have a professional PR person. And I guess I had it in my head, again, before I started doing this work, that you had to be this really big company for it to make sense to have a PR person. That's not the case, is it?
No, in fact, it's almost more important in a smaller organization. You may wear multiple hats. You know, particularly in a small nonprofit, you may be the PR person, the marketing person, you may be a development person, all the above. Every organization needs a conscience like a public relations person to keep an eye on, are we doing the right thing for our stakeholders? So it applies across the board.
Now, is there, when you guys begin an engagement with a client, that you have to have a deep dive, I guess, to really understand the why of the company and what makes them tick a little bit, right? Is that kind of a universal practice of the first kind of get together?
Absolutely. You never want to start a program without some good research. And quite often, even if a client comes to us and says, oh, we have all of this research that we've already done, we will say, but we want to do our own. We want to do more.
So you want to get it like out of the horse's mouth so you hear the words yourself, not like here's some documents that we printed, you know, 5 years ago, and that'll get you up to speed.
Absolutely, because quite often the clients are much too close to the situation. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason they're hiring a firm is so that they've got somebody who can bring an outside perspective to them. So we'd never start an engagement without you know, really doing our homework.
And that's top level, the top level typically for you guys. You want to get it from the horse's mouth from leadership, and then do you sometimes kind of interview people at the lower levels as well?
Do both, and then interview customers. We're doing engagement right now for a state of Georgia government office, and we've talked to the people who benefit from their programs. We've talked to their partners who implement the programs in the state. We've talked to similar programs in states across the country to get a 360-degree perspective on that, to make sure that we, you know, so that we see the full picture.
And they were all 100% completely aligned right out of the box, right?
yes. They're never always completely aligned. In fact, they're often not aligned.
Now, how do you kind of coach them up and create those? They probably share stories that you're like, wow, that's something great. That's gold, right? And they don't realize they have gold maybe sometimes, and you're trying to bubble that up. How do you kind of help them get the messaging right?
That is probably the key to this all. Whether somebody is looking for good media coverage or just wants to tell their story to a particular customer, it's those anecdotes, those success stories, those testimonials that make all the difference in the world. People want facts and proof points behind it. They mm-hmm. want to see that you've actually helped somebody, a customer or a client, get through their achieve their goals. And so it's like pulling teeth sometimes to draw it out of them, because a lot of times clients will want to go back into facts and statistics, which are important, but PR people, what we try to teach our clients is how to be storytellers. You know, it's all about how do we help you make a connection with your audience and weave a story in such a way that it's so compelling that the person you're trying to reach says, my gosh, I've got to hire them.
Right, and that connection is driven through emotion, not through facts, right? And that's
completely.
I guess the clients a lot of time thinks like, well, look at this fact sheet. That shows how awesome we are, and it's just dry numbers. And you'd rather have that anecdote that illustrates some of those numbers, right?
You know, I wish I was the person who had said, people don't know how much you care until they care, or people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
That's a good one.
Now that I said it's a brilliant point. I couldn't say it right, but it's absolutely true. It's we are human beings first and foremost, and we've got a rational side and an emotional side. But when you're trying to push the buttons to change somebody's behavior, get them to act the way you want them to act, it really comes down to, are you making that emotional connection?
Right. And it's those things that. Is it difficult for you from a PR standpoint when they go, well, what's the ROI of PR? And it's like, I don't know, what's the ROI of the guy who came up with just do it? You know, it was just three simple words. Anybody could have come up with them, but that message and emotion that it conveys is priceless.
You know, more and more public relations in particular has gotten very sophisticated in terms of how we measure, whether it's the outputs or the outcomes that we do. Clients more and more are demanding, just like with an advertising spend or any marketing piece of their marketing mix, they want to see how what activity you've done translates into the bottom line for them. Mm-hmm. And so gone are the days when you can say, oh yeah, we got you a story on the front page of the Journal Constitution. Woohoo, that's great. You've got to find ways to actually make that connection to what it does to the bottom line. Were your messages positive? Did it reach the right audience? You know, a whole litany of things you've got to think through.
So now, is there universal PR rules about that? Or is that something like a Golan Harris has their own methodology that you filter everything through and that gives them kind of an ROI?
Every agency probably has its own take on it, but there have been a group of measurement experts from around the world who've gotten together over the past few years and have developed what are called the Barcelona principles. And I'm jealous that I didn't get invited to Barcelona to invent these ideas. But they're kind of seven keys to what effective measurement looks like. Mm-hmm. And those are being built upon and replicated throughout the profession more and more moving forward. And it's all about being able to tie what you do back to the bottom line.
But to get the best return sustained over time, I have to believe the relationship. I mean, you got to have a relationship and a level of trust with your PR person. You got to be able to tell that person stuff you don't tell your CPA or your spouse, I would think. Right? Because you got to have the truth to be grounded.
You never want to be surprised. It's, you know, we always better that we have a good sense of where the skeletons may be buried before something happens. And if you can be upfront and honest with us, you know what I found is that Americans are incredibly forgiving people. And if you do something wrong and you apologize and you make amends, 9 times out of 10, you'll get past it. It's when you try to cover it up or try to hide it or try to act like it wasn't your fault without pointing fingers, you know, to some of the big crises that have happened to the country. When you're just honest about it, people will give you the benefit of the doubt.
So now, as a career, you felt it was important, obviously, to be part of the PRSA. Is that, you think every PR person should join PRSA and be that active internally in that industry's kind of whatever the trade organization is?
I will tell you that it's made all the difference in the world for me. The people that I met as I started out in this city 22 years ago in the profession are still my best friends today. And if I needed something, I could still pick up the phone and call them and get help. If I found myself in need of a job tomorrow, I would have a network of folks to start with. If I need advice on just how do you handle something that I've never handled before, they're the people I would go to first. So it's incredibly important. And what I would wish is that more people, particularly as they progress in their career, would see the importance of staying engaged and involved, because I think it's very helpful when you're straight out of school, but I think it can be helpful throughout your career.
And it's not just write them a check and say you're a member. It's important to just really get involved and volunteer, head committees. You know, that immerses you in the industry and where you can build that Rolodex that has the people that are watching your back throughout your career.
Absolutely. It doesn't mean half as much if you don't get involved and take advantage of that. I was president of the local chapter 11 years ago. And it's where I formed my strongest relationships. It's where it taught me leadership skills. I learned how to manage budgets and committees and volunteers and skills that have served me well throughout everything else I've done.
Even though that it was like, oh, man, now I got my own job. Now I got this other job that I'm volunteering. And while there were times you were probably cursing it, looking back, it was probably time well spent.
An incredible professional development. I mean, it was meaningful work, but it also... It gave me skills that I would probably not have gotten someplace else, invaluable training.
So, and there's education and credentialing in the PR arena as well. You mentioned at the very top of the conversation what a collaborative group public relations professionals are. Is it just because there's so much business here in town, or it goes beyond that? Dennis, just why are they so collaborative? Because I got to tell you, I was a little surprised that you guys hung out as much as you did and helped each other as much as you did.
You know, some people's theory is because the fact that we are in the South and people may be just a little bit nicer here. I think that's just the nature of Atlanta, though. It's a can-do city, and we've shown it time and again from Dr. King to the Olympics that this is just a place where when people set their mind to getting something done, they do it. And the only way to do it is by bringing the right people together to make it happen. It's just a part of what makes Atlanta unique.
And we do, and it's interesting for us, we talk to people in a lot of different sectors around town, obviously. And we had, I think it was somebody from economic development or somebody in one of the business centers here in town. And they were saying that that's kind of the secret sauce of Atlanta compared to other parts of the country. Yeah. And we were interviewing somebody from the Northeast that came here, and she was saying, in the North, I won't mention the city. In that city, it's more of a zero-sum game. It's like they're looking at, I'm looking for a way, an edge over you, so I'm not helping you. You're on your own. But coming down here, everybody's looking out, trying to find ways to work together and collaborate and share things. And it was like a breath of fresh air for her.
That's absolutely the case. And I do think it, to your point, I do think it sets us apart and gives us a competitive advantage when we're trying to recruit new businesses to the state or whatever we're doing. I think it's a plus that other communities wish they had.
Now, if somebody listening was maybe a student or they're thinking about getting involved with PRSA, do you have the PRSA website?
Absolutely. It's simple. It's prsageorgia.org. And you can go there to find networking events, professional development, job listings, anything that you need.
And your name on that Order of the Phoenix list, right?
My name and my
and
name.
Margaret.
And Margaret Mitchell. Absolutely.
And then Golan Harris, if somebody has a need for you guys, his website?
Easy as well, golanharris.com. And you can learn more about us and our 39 offices around the world and all the great work we do for clients.
Mark, thanks for coming out and hanging with us, man.
Thanks, you both.
Yeah, you going to stay here for a little bit while we visit with our other guests?
Absolutely.
All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us from Literacy Action, Mr. Austin Dixon. How you doing, man?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
What'd you learn in that last segment?
I learned a lot, actually. Also identified a lot with what we do about collaboration and also about marketing and messaging. I'm the executive director, but I'm also the marketing consultant and director. I'm also the chief fundraiser a lot of the time.
You probably get three separate salaries, don't you?
No. I wish.
And what order are you part of? Mark's got the Phoenix. What are you?
Well, that's a good question.
We'll have to create one for him. The order of the microphone.
Yeah.
So what is the Literacy Action group about?
Sure. Literacy Action, we were founded in downtown Atlanta in 1968. So we are 45 years old this year, and we are the largest and leading adult basic education nonprofit in the Southeast. And what that means is that we teach adults how to read, write, and do math. Here in Georgia, there are 1.3 million people over the age of 25 who don't have a high school credential. That's about 9% of the state. And so the work that we do is we take adults who've fallen through the cracks either last year or 25 years ago, and we try to move them towards better wages or a certain functionality goal or to get that GED and get into technical college.
Now, 1.3 million. That seems like a really large number, 9%.
Yes, sir.
Wow. That's got to be very limiting in terms of your ability to earn money, provide for a family.
Absolutely.
I mean, the income for somebody that can't read and write has got to be substantially lower.
The average income of people that walk in our door is $11,000 a year.
Wow.
Now,
pretty hard to live on that.
Do a person who doesn't know how to read and write, how are they even raising their hand to get help?
That's a really good question. Most of our folks can read and write to some degree, but it's their academic skills that are extremely low. So 80% of the people that walk in our door read on the fourth grade level, which you can navigate the world decently on a fourth grade reading level, but not too well. And also, on average, folks who walk in our door can't multiply or divide. So they're usually on about a second or third grade reading level. So can you imagine not being able to multiply and divide in your daily life?
Well, I could probably imagine not being able to divide so well.
So a lot of our clients really do have some serious struggles, and so they find themselves in situations, employment situations or living situations where they have really little control over their lives and little agency to speak up. Don't really know when they're getting swindled, don't know how to calculate interest, for example. So when we talk to a lot of our families about thinking about their housing situation or their mortgage or their rent, you know, they don't ask a lot of questions, so there's a lot of fear and shame, and there's a whole lot of issues wrapped up in being a low literate adult.
But how do they find you or you find them? Like, what's the pain there? Like, they've navigated life to a certain degree with these skills, so what makes them say, you know what? Enough is enough. I got to get help.
It really depends. About 80% of the people that walk in our door freely choose to show up. And so we have relationships with homeless shelters, with the juvenile justice system, with housing authorities, transitional housing facilities. We're also 45 years old. So a lot of people say, my friend told me about this group. I was at my church and I saw a flyer for Literacy Action, or my pastor told me that you guys are really good at helping people like me out, and so I'd love to check it out. So a lot of it is word of mouth. Some of it is through institutional relationships and referrals.
So what's your backstory? How did you get involved with this kind of work?
Sure. Well, I started my career at the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. So I was used to giving away money to nonprofits, and now I'm asking for money for nonprofits generally.
Which hat do you like to wear?
I like asking for money. I like getting people excited about the work that we do, and that's really what fundraising is about. It's about PR. It's about communication of messages to donors, and we've got a pretty compelling message. There's a need, and we do it well. But my background was in philanthropy, and so I come at it from a nonprofit business perspective. But also, I'm a philosophy professor at Clayton State. I've been doing that for about 6 years. So, and I have too many master's degrees. So I have a passion for education.
What's the answer to that whole tree falling in the forest question?
I'll leave that unknown.
It's 11.
11. Got it.
So now, when you're out there trying to fundraise, are you going to corporations for funds? Or are you going to, are you spreading the word through, you mentioned churches. Where's the place you go?
We have a $1.2 million budget this year, and our budget supported in fourths. So a fourth is individual donations, a fourth is from Atlanta companies, a fourth is from foundations, and a fourth is from the Technical College System of Georgia and county governments. So the Technical College System of Georgia is responsible for adult basic education, which is what we do in the state. But a lot of my time is spent on public relations, talking to companies about why investing in literacy action is economic development for the state.
So you're keep mentioning public relations, so I'm going to have to bring Mark back in. Sorry, Mark.
Yeah, you have to clock back in, Mark.
So now, how does a PR firm like Golin Harris help a nonprofit like Literacy Action?
You know, that's another one of the things that I think makes this community so wonderful is that the agencies quite often will adopt or work with nonprofits and help them with whatever it is they've needed to do. We do that for a couple of nonprofits in town. You know, some with larger budgets have paying budgets, but a lot of them just need somebody to come in and give a little bit of advice here and there. And I think it's part of doing business in this town is you open your heart and your checkbook up to some extent, and you do what you can do.
So the leadership finds a cause that they're passionate about or that resonates with them, and they say, you know, we're going to put some energy and some of our time and people on this?
You know, it doesn't have to be the leadership. Quite often it can bubble up from anybody in the organization, anybody who's got a real passion for the work who will come in and say, hey, look, I think that this cause is worth some of our attention. Can we do a brainstorm for them? Can we, you know, can we have a messaging session? Can we do a little bit of media outreach? I'm on the board of a couple nonprofits in town, and my firm's been incredibly generous to help those organizations. It's particularly for younger folks, it's great skill development to get a chance to do things that you may not get to do with the largest client that you might have.
So what's the threshold from low literate adult to that next level that, you know, you invest time, energy, resources, and you get them to that next level, and so you have some semblance of success? What's that next threshold, high school or?
Generally for us, it's getting folks on the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade levels. It's at that level of education that you can take the GED, that you can take the Compass test for university system and technical college. And it's also at that level that there's a lot of tests and exams that employers offer so that you can move towards a higher wage or a management position. Maybe you're a janitor for a building downtown, but you can't be a manager without passing a certain test that tests math skills, and et cetera. And so we try to get folks to pass whatever that test is in their field.
So now what is your like working relationship with somebody that has a literacy challenge? Like they come, they find out about you and they go, I can't read, or I have trouble reading, or I want to read better, or I want to learn more math. So they come there every week, every month. You give them an iPad. Like what happens?
I wish we could give them an iPad. We recently had a donation from Dell of 45 laptops to use in our classrooms,
wow,
which is awesome.
Yeah.
But we are basically a free school. So we have 3 15-week semesters a year. People come in and take a test. They get placed with a registrar, just like you would have in college. Classes meet 2 or 3 times a week, 2 or 3 hours at a time. There is a paid instructor and 2 volunteers in every classroom. We have 40 classes going on today.
And they don't pay.
Everything is free of charge. So it's basically a free school that you enroll in. And because every seat is supported by donor dollars, if you don't show up after a series of class sessions, we record that and we tell you you have to stop out and maybe come next semester, and we'll put somebody on the waiting list into the class so that there's no empty seat. Our waiting list averages about 250 people at any given time.
So you need more bodies and space to help these people that are on waiting lists?
Our services are a function of money and space, and we actually are expanding to the entire 6th floor of the United Way building downtown where we are. Right now we have half the floor, and January 1 we'll be expanding, so we'll be doubling our capacity and hopefully eliminating the waiting list. One thing I wanted to go back on the PR is that I think a company like Golin Harris has a great reputation in town for being very generous to nonprofits. A lot of nonprofits, too, really have to cobble things together. So sometimes an organization might find a Golin Harris who very holistically takes over a nonprofit's marketing platform for a period of time. At Literacy Action, for example, we haven't been fortunate to have that relationship, but you know, we do have a company that prints all of our materials for free. We had a company come in and help us with a logo and branding platform. It was an 8-month process, interviews, et cetera, some charrettes. The board got involved. It was a wonderful gift to the organization, valued at about $30,000. We, like I mentioned, we're expanding to the entire sixth floor of the United Way building, and we have no clue about interior design. So an interior design firm has adopted us to do some sketches and pick some colors for us. So nonprofits do what they can with donations to pull together their programming. But I think also when it comes to stuff like PR, nonprofits can find companies that are interested in a piece of what they're trying to do. And companies are usually, here in Atlanta, very generous.
It's absolutely remarkable what you're accomplishing. It sounds like you do have a lot of folks here in town, once again, that genuinely want to support your efforts. And let's be real, if I'm reasonably literate about my math, you got 1.3 million little literate adults, you got a $1.2 million budget, you got less than a buck a piece to try to attack this problem, so you could always use more money. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, we are a nonprofit that's trying to fight a social problem that we've had it for generations. So Literacy Action itself is not going to solve the idea that we have all these low literate Georgians and get them working into the economy. But what we can do is we can be a center for excellence for teaching adults. And so that's what we aim to do. And we grow through partnerships throughout the city and try to model what best practices are so that other institutions like technical colleges can take on this work throughout the state.
Have you ever had the opportunity to witness someone come through your program and either immediately or down the road, some come back and want to give back to the program in some way and share their experiences or maybe even teach or help teach?
Every week we have that opportunity.
Man, how cool that must be.
Yeah,
huh?
One of our board members is a former student who came to us with a fourth grade education, and she wanted to get her GED before her son graduated from high school. So she came to us and spent 2 years and moved up, and now she wouldn't mind me saying she's an employee at Gwinnett Medical Center. She's been there for 4 years. And she's doing great, and she's a great board member who contributes financially and also on the board and then volunteers in a classroom. And that's just one example of folks who come back all the time and encourage folks. A lot of education is about encouragement, and so we have folks constantly coming back to talk to classes, to volunteer in the classroom, and donate funds.
But those stories are PR gold, right? That's exactly what you're looking for, isn't it?
It's exactly what you're looking for. It's there. If you can collect those stories and find ways to communicate those with other people, I mean, what donor wouldn't want to know that the organization has been so powerful that you've got former students who've come back and have joined the board? I mean, that's a huge testament to the quality of the organization.
Now, how much of your time is spent with kind of creating this learning methodology that helps people learn as quickly as they can to help get the results that they need, since they are adults already? I mean, they're kind of on a clock, right, that they have to get these skills quickly.
Very much so. And it really depends on who the adult is. So we might have folks who are younger, who just got out of a gang or got out of jail or dropped out of school to have a child a couple of years ago, or you might have somebody who's 50 years old and is really taking a look at their life and wants something better. So it depends on who the person is and what kind of educational roadmap we have for them. But my program director has a PhD in educational psychology, and we spend a lot of time working on our curriculum and our teaching. A lot of people say, oh, you're a literacy group, you must read books to children. And that's not exactly what we do. And then other people say, you know, I'd love to volunteer. I'd love to help somebody read. Well, you know, teaching someone to read is actually an art and a science. And, you know, it's not something that's done very easily. So all of our teachers are professionally trained in adult education.
Now, but is the ability to teach somebody that's already gone through some schooling and is now they're volunteering for this, right? They're coming here voluntarily to come and
learn.
The
students?
Right,
yes.
The students. So that's different than, you know, somebody that's in seventh grade or eighth grade that, you know, kind of have to be there.
Right.
So are you piloting different kind of the techniques of how to teach these people better? Or is it you have a curriculum because you're a bunch of smart people that are PhDs in education and they know how to do this? Or are you also, at the same time, you know what I'm saying, is how do you do the teaching part of this?
Do you mean we're constantly testing out what works and what doesn't work?
Like, and there's a best practice, and this is the best practice today.
There is a best practice, but it's also evolving. So we are directly across the street from the Georgia State College of Education, and they have students and faculty in our offices constantly interviewing our students, testing our students, writing research papers. So we're essentially a living learning lab.
So you're like a lab for them in some ways.
In some ways, yes.
And that's important, right? Because you're trying to... And especially with technology changing so rapidly, there might be some technology like Dell, you mentioned, donated a bunch of laptops. There might be some software solutions that help somebody have the practice and learn.
Absolutely.
Kind of on their own, right?
There is tons of stuff on the internet now, which is awesome. And I'd like to use more of it in our classes. I'd love for every student to have an iPad. I think that would be great. We don't have those resources right now.
Or a Dell tablet.
Absolutely. Or any kind of tablet device would be great because there are a lot of enhancements through internet-based technologies that can help in the classroom. Khan Academy is a great example. I haven't spent a lot of time on it, but I do know that a lot of groups like us kind of lean almost too heavily on something like a Khan Academy to get the work done.
Well, the reason I'm asking is we have a show that's called Learning Insights, and it's about training and development in corporations. That's the focus of it. But they have... online learning, mobile learning, like there's all kinds of learning that's happening in a corporate arena that seems to be a little bit ahead of what's happening like in the, you know, primary education arena. You know, they're trying different things faster and iterating faster because they need to get the results that they need to get from a business standpoint. And it's less bureaucratic because, you know, they're more nimble than a public school can be. And I don't know if you guys work with any of those.
We don't, but I'd like to learn more about it for sure.
All right, maybe we'll connect you with that. And maybe you'd be a good guest on that show with somebody that's maybe the training person at like a large company here in town, and maybe there's ways to work there that maybe you haven't considered.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, earlier, actually it was in the first segment, we talked a little bit about ROI and impact. And I don't know how in the world you ever measure it, but just think about the impact of the work these folks are doing. I can remember when I first successfully sent a text message with my phone. And how much more erect in the seat I sat, how much prouder I walked down the street. Can you imagine that person in a lower-level job that's been below a fourth-grade reading level all that time and now can read and write and add and subtract and multiply and divide? The impact that it must have on that person's self-confidence and the way he or she interacts with people around them, you have no idea where that ripple goes. That's a...
We have folks that they'll come back with their GED test scores in their hand, and they will bust through the door screaming and jumping around. You would have thought they were in the Order of Phoenix or something. They are life changers, and that's why they come back and volunteer and share their stories. In fact, the AJC ran an article on us in August of 2012 highlighting folks that really had gone through our program and had transformational experiences. And you know, everybody in our program is looking for that experience. And so it's a model for folks who haven't gotten there yet. But absolutely. It's utter joy.
And you must sleep incredibly well. And I think that person is probably investing more time and energy with his or her kids. You know, they're not frustrated and yelling at their spouse because they're, I mean, a lot about their life changes and that, therefore a lot about the way they interact with other people in their lives change.
Absolutely. 90% of the folks that we have in our classes have children in the home. And, you know, we say that we're a nonprofit driver of economic development, which is true, and that's how the technical college system sees us. But also, I think we're a transformative organization that offers freedom. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, you know, education is essentially an issue of freedom and how much you can do in this world or how much you can't. And so I sleep well at night because I know that we're offering a certain level of freedom for individuals.
Man, you got to keep up the good work. And let's do that. Let's get him connected with some of the folks that we're getting to know through the Learning Insights show.
I just think there's so much opportunity. What they're doing, what I'm seeing them do for businesses, it has to translate to education.
Absolutely.
For people who...
Just plug different content into those same mechanisms,
right? Because people learn in different ways. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to efficiently match them up with the right way to teach them, then they're going to learn a lot faster.
Sounds like a scalable model for sure. Well, here we are in Atlanta collaborating. I like
that's
it.
That's right. And in the next segment, we're going to learn how to sell the idea. So we're covered.
Awesome.
Well,
One-stop shop.
What do you need from our listeners? How can we all help you?
Sure. Well, our website's literacyaction.org, and there you can make a donation. You can sign up to volunteer. You can learn more about the issue in general, or you could come for a visit.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming down and hanging with us, man. And let's get them. We're going to have you back.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Yes, sir. Stay with us while we visit with our last guest, will you?
Please.
All right. Now from Jones Simply Sales, cleverly named, after the owner, the grand poobah, the CEO, where the buck stops, Mr. Dick Jones. Hey, man.
Hey, Stone. How are you?
I'm doing well. What'd you sell today?
Nothing. But I have enjoyed the conversation of my two colleagues here. Number one, my daughter did graduate from the Grady School at University of Georgia. She did get two internships up in Chicago and has moved on since to become a senior account executive with a major Fortune 100 company. It's a tremendous industry, and as we talked about that and I've listened to you today, it makes me very proud of what she's doing. And certainly also with Austin, I've actively participated in volunteering a lot of my time to nonprofit organizations. Atlanta's a hotbed for nonprofit organizations, and everyone's out there trying to serve a cause. And it's amazing what has gone on in my experience with that. So I've enjoyed the conversation from both of them.
Well, now, a little bit about you. How are you out there in the marketplace helping folks?
My focus is on small businesses. My career started in the corporate world. I worked for IBM for 17 years, and during that time, I had a lot of opportunity to work with small businesses. Back in the early 80s when I started, and most of the time, it was looking at technology and how they could automate some of their processes and not have to hire additional people as they grew. And that's evolved over the time into the new millennium, where there's a lot of things available for small businesses, and a lot of them simply don't know what they don't know, as you said earlier, Stone. It's my goal to try to help small business owners uncover some of the benefits of having management systems, you know, more improved processes, and also technology, and leveraging that to make them more effective and efficient in what they do, with a primary goal of growing sales, improving their profitability, attracting new customers while at the same time retaining their customers, and increasing the value of their business. For me, that is, you know, teaching small business owners how to spend more time working on their business than actually in their business, which is a very difficult challenge.
Well, you mentioned small business at the top of this. What is your definition of a small business?
Well, that's a good question. The SBA, Small Business Administration, defines it, you know, as anything lower than a, you know, $50 million company.
Right. But a $50 million company and a $1 million company. It's hard to put in the same bucket.
Are totally different, yeah. My focus is primarily on businesses that are about $15 million or smaller, mm-hmm. with employee sizes anywhere from 5 to 10 employees up to maybe 30 or 40 employees.
And then what's the pain they're having where they go, I got to call Dick?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different pain that small businesses can have. I write a weekly business advice column for the local paper up in North Fulton. And, you know, it's probably about 85 or so different articles that I've written. So you can't approach this in a cookie cutter model. You have to actually go in and sit down with a business owner, really get to understand what they're trying to do, what their vision is for their business, what their strategy is in getting there, and help them to align the critical components of their business to that. Those critical components could include, amongst other things, the structure of the organization. Do they have the right resources? We've heard conversations here about wearing multiple hats in a business. That's very commonplace in small business. But as businesses grow, they may need to add an incremental resource to focus on one specific function, or maybe outsource that and have that done by an outside organization. The systems that they use and how they automate their business is also an important thing. The people that they attract, which is probably one of the top challenges small business owners are facing today. I can get into that a little bit more later if you'd like. And then how people are rewarded, because turnover in small business with the millennial generation is going up a lot. I mentioned my daughter before. I mean, she, you know, was in three or four jobs before she got, you know, to where she's now. She's only been out of college college for about 4 or 5 years. So it's, you know, a lot different than my generation, where when you started with a company, you thought you'd be there and get the golden watch and retire. That no longer exists in today's business world.
So when you're meeting with people, particularly on the lower end of that continuum of the $1 million to $50 million, a lot of times you're looking at a self-made person. They've kind of flown in the face of convention even to get where they're going. They're not used to necessarily taking a lot of advice, particularly recently. Is it sometimes a matter of not being aware of technology that could serve them, or is it more along the lines of just resisting it?
You know, that's a great question, because I hear that.
I thought
that
was a fantastic
question. I hear that.
It was
that
a little long, but we got around to the point, didn't we?
I hear that all the time. You know, small business owners know what they know, and it's usually about a specific industry they're in or a specific product or service they provide, but they certainly don't know everything about everything. And uncovering, you know, what they are trying to do and what they're actually executing. And they could have a pretty good strategy on paper, but strategy formulation is relatively easy versus strategy execution. So uncovering what they may not know is the first step. I found out through running my own business and running and talking with small businesses that even if they were aware of this, they might not have the time to do it. You know, small business owners will tell you that they would give $1,000 per week to get an extra couple hours in their day. And, you know, it's a true story. I mean, they're working long hours. They're doing a lot of things. They've got a lot of balls in the air. And, you know, sometimes these things, even though they know that they're good for their business, they just don't have the time to implement them. So there's options for that I provide them with. And those options could include partnering with my organization to teach them how to do it, you know, hiring someone and training them on how to execute something, or outsourcing. There's a lot of things you can do today in small business world that you couldn't do 10 years ago. Software, as an example, and the expense of installing that, implementing that, maintaining that, and all of that. Well, software as a service, as an example, is a big, huge solution for a lot of small business owners today, because there's no maintenance. All you do is, you know, sign in, do your thing, and you don't have to worry about all that. And a lot of people don't know that that's available to them.
Right. You mentioned technology tools. I'm assuming this is what you're talking about here. What are some of the technology tools a small business person should consider?
Well, you know, if you have to look at the DNA of a small business and what they're trying to accomplish. You know, at the top of the list right now for small businesses, according to a study recently done, is revenue growth. You know, number two is, you know, retaining their existing resources. You know, number three is attracting new people. And number four is the Affordable Health Care Act. And those are the top four. So if you look at the top one, you know, getting new revenue, it's 10 times easier to have your existing customers buy additional products and services than trying to go out and attract new business. So first and foremost, they need to be in touch with their current customers. And there's technology that can be used today to maintain constant contact with your customers through email marketing, social media, and make sure that your customers are aware of what you're doing. Now, to do that, they have to provide valuable and relevant information to them, something that people want and something that they'll read and something that they'll look at and hopefully share with others, which will help attract new customers. If you're in a B2B world, Salesforce automation with cloud tools like Salesforce.com, as an example, can be easily implemented at a low cost, and it really takes away the management of a salesperson's opportunities that usually would be done on something like an Excel spreadsheet or manually, and puts it into a tool that really helps improve the efficiency and effectiveness of that person.
So how about attracting new people? Like, we have Kevin. Kevin, I don't know if your mic's open or not. Kevin, relatively young guy, certainly younger than Lee and I, and he is stellar. He does a fabulous job with our clients and our guests and all that stuff. But you know where I found Kevin? He's like my cousin's best friend. I don't know how to go get the next Kevin.
Should we just go on Craigslist?
Right?
There's a lot of ways that the younger generation is trying to identify opportunities that is different than what we might think. The job board's probably not going to cut it, yet there's a lot out there. There are more people who would find something on social sites about a particular opportunity and be able to relate to that and make a call and identify people that way. You know, I don't know how old you are. Or
26.
26, perfect candidate. Yeah, I mean, how often do you, you know, go to job boards to look for opportunities?
Hopefully not very often.
No, not at all.
But isn't part of the trick, too, and I think we successfully did this, but I think I could see myself falling into the trap of hiring in my own image. Like, and that's the last thing we need is another stone around here, right? We need different types.
I will say yes. That is the last thing we would.
No comment.
But does that ever come up, like, where they try to just hire themselves and that just duplicates the effort?
Well, once again, you know, you're looking at an organizational dynamic model. You've got your strategy, you've got the structure of your organization, you've got the systems and processes, and then you've got the people and their skills. So if you have that alignment back to your strategy, you know, it's when it comes down to looking at what your structure of your organization is and what type of people do you want to have. In most cases, you don't want to have someone who's got the same skill set as you do. You want to have someone who's got more deep skills in a particular area. You know, in the corporate world, there were functions. You know, there's an accounting function, a sales function, a marketing function, you name it. In small business, they don't have those functions. It's multiple hats, and it's people.
Well, you have those needs, but you may not have a...
You have all those
needs. You don't have a body on each one of them.
That's his exactly job right. description is whatever I dropped.
Exactly.
That's Kevin's job, is whatever I dropped.
Right, but the job was probably to offload some of those responsibilities from what you were already doing.
Right.
And they don't necessarily mean he's going to pick up everything but a piece of that. So when you are hiring someone, it's a real important thing, which a lot of small business owners don't do, is to, you know, bring the person in and say, there's your desk, get at it. No, they have to have a very structured onboarding process. There needs to be some training. There needs to be some standard operating procedures put in place. Small business owners simply don't have time to do that. They don't have the time, and what ends up happening is they spend five times as much time correcting problems and issues and challenges because people aren't onboarded right, they're not trained right, there's no procedures. So I try to show them the value of putting that in place. And
right, developing the systems that allow you to kind of plug and play.
That's exactly right.
So now, I guess your background at IBM, that helped you quite a bit in that type of structure, learning about the structure and the importance of that.
Well, I always, play on words, say that IBM had processes for sharpening a pencil. They were very rigorous in their processes. Definable, repeatable processes that are measured and tracked can lead to better results. Because if your process is not working, it's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So at the end of the day, businesses are driven off of processes that need to be measured, and if they're measured and they're tracked, then you can see if initiatives that you're implementing are actually working. And if not, you can change your processes. I've worked with a lot of small businesses who haven't had documented procedures. And by doing that, it made it a lot easier for the people who had to execute those procedures to specifically understand what they needed to do, why they needed to do it, and what the rewards were going to be for them to actually do it correctly.
Now, do you have a sweet spot of type of business you work with?
Well, yeah, I do. It's funny that a lot of my corporate background was in the business-to-business space, but primarily I work with business who has consumers as customers because it's a neat model out there called engagement marketing. Engagement marketing is probably the most newest form of marketing right now. Gail Goodman, who's the CEO of Constant Contact, which is the largest email marketing system in the world, wrote a book about it. And, you know, in order to make that successful, you have to have a wow experience for your customers. If you don't do that, well, who the heck cares? So given that you have a wow experience, then you need to keep in touch with people. You need to make sure that they know and provide them with relevant value information and use your social media to, you know, give them something to talk about and share that with your friends. Word of mouth is the easiest way to get new business, and this just takes word of mouth and puts it on steroids. So in that space, there's all sorts of kind of B2C people, anything from retail stores, antique malls, landscape companies, professional services companies, and the list goes on and on and on and on. So that's really where I focus.
So this strikes me as another one of those situations like we were talking with Mark earlier in the show. for you to really serve me well as a business owner, I mean, I got to open the kimono. I got to talk to you like I do my therapist, my divorce attorney, for you to be genuinely helpful. So, and I suspect when those conversations take place, they probably go really well and you get a lot of that work. My question to you as a Simply Sales guy, how do you even get that first how do you get in the door to have this level of conversation with people?
Well, you know, there are a lot of times the referrals that I get from others that have used my services and have had some success will get me in the door. Other times you have to actually call up and ask, you know, people for the opportunity to sit down with them and talk with them about the way that you can help them grow their business. And who in a small business today wouldn't want to hear that advice? Sometimes people don't have time right then and there, but you make that time. There's success stories. I have, you know, articles in the paper that attract a lot of customers. It's about a lot of different topics. Someone sees something that's very interesting to them. They pick up the phone or send me an email. So that's how normally.
And you eat some
there.
Of your own cooking and do this engagement marketing like you were describing and try to help people with thought leadership and stuff.
That's a great point. You're absolutely right. I absolutely use what I do and do what I use. And it works for me. You know, I have, once again, you know, I hope I provide a wow experience to my customers. They've told me that. And I share that with them. I give them relevant and valuable information through a monthly email newsletter. And I'm very active on the social media sites to make sure people know what's going on in the small business world.
You're
going to
see that in the next Golin Harris campaign, I'll bet you. Do what I use and use what I do. Be on the lookout for that. That's pretty strong.
Well, you know, it's interesting in the nonprofit world, and you may relate to this, that, you know, at least I can with, you know, annual campaigns where you reach out for money, and people give you that money. But, you know, they never really hear about what's that money done. You know, how's it been used? What are the results? And all of a sudden, you're around to the next year reaching, putting the tin can out. And those are things I think that would really help the nonprofit industry. Stay in touch with current donors and have a vehicle for saying, you gave money, and this is what we've done
right.
to that money.
It's the stories. The stories
really
are critical.
Is. It really is.
The number one thing that people tell me when they say they stopped giving is because we stopped communicating.
Yeah, there right. you go.
There you
wow,
go. Exactly.
What a shame.
You know, what's interesting, though, is having a nonprofit background is there's a threshold, though, over which people don't want you to spend any more money communicating with them. Unfortunately, it takes some infrastructure building to do that. And, you know, they want you to use the money to help people directly. But you need to invest in that communications or else you won't get the repeat donors.
Right. It's that balance. All right, Dick. Somebody want to learn more? Website?
Yeah, my website is simplysalesllc.com, and you can log on there and get a look at the business value methodology that we use, products and services, and contact information.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of this today.
Thanks a lot, Lee and Stone.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and all our guests today. We will see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.